Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. In today's fast-paced, fast-food world, we all seem to be eating alone all the time, whether it's at our desks or in our car. And as much as we feel cut off from our friends and families, we certainly feel even more disconnected from all the other people in our vast foodscapes. Yet according to Michael Carolan in his book, No One Eats Alone, whether or not we realize it, every single person who eats is connected by food and affected by everyone else's in our foodscapes. This morning, we talk with Michael Carolan about how we become citizen eaters rather than consumer eaters when we reconnect with who grows and distributes the food we eat and who shapes our decisions about what we eat. Michael, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
So I'd like to start by asking you about the title of your book. What do you mean by No One Eats Alone?
Yeah, that's a good question. I do get that a lot. It actually means a couple things, and part of the reason why I titled that is simply to kind of evoke that question, because we're often told that we do eat alone. So the book is an artifact of me having the opportunity to interview literally hundreds of different people that are part of what I call our foodscapes, or what's perhaps more conventionally called food systems. And I use this as an opportunity to remind audiences and readers that our food connects us in lots of ways beyond just our ability to go to the grocery store, but there's also farmers, which we know about, but beyond that, there's a whole system that lies behind kind of that curtain that a lot of eaters don't tend to think about. We're often told, for instance, that if we could just trace our food back to the farmer, then we would have complete knowledge when it comes to what makes our food. And I give one example from the book, for instance, is if you were to trace your milk back to the dairy, you would think that you have the whole story behind that particular food item. But beyond just the milk itself, there are, for instance, the vitamins that go into fortifying that milk. So according to U.S. Regulations, you have to fortify our milk with vitamin D. Well, where does that vitamin D come from? And I tell one story in the book where I trace that vitamin D back to a plant in China that specializes in making industrialized vitamins for the fortification of food. And coincidentally, most of that vitamin D is actually extracted from lanolin from sheep in Australia. And so there's this whole story of food that we don't hear told that goes beyond just the traceability back to the farm itself. But then there's also this other element of our food that we don't tend to think about. And I think it disadvantages alternative food networks because they tend to focus on, and rightly so, issues of accessibility and price. But there's this whole other army that's at work when it comes to the industrial foodscape that's been in place now for generations, that's whose duty it is, in a sense, to make us want or quote-unquote choose industrialized food. And so there was one individual that I interviewed from London who was a marketing, he's now retired, but he was in a marketing business for close to 50 years. And he had talked about in an interview very interestingly how his job early on, decades ago, was to nick certain skills. He used that term nick, and it was just to talk about how in order to get people hooked on industrial food, one of the things you have to do is first of all make them forget how to process and prepare fresh food items. And so one of the barriers now that we often encounter when you talk to people who may be able to afford and may have access to fresh fruits and vegetables is that they no longer have the skills to prepare them properly, and that in and of itself is a significant barrier. And so my point is just to remind folks that are working for promoting alternative foodscapes that there's more to that than just making sure that it's available and that it's cheap. You have to think about how can you provide people with the skills to prepare them. You have to think about things like conviviality. Coca-Cola had famously what's referred to as the ubiquity strategy, whereas they realize that you have to make Coke fun. And when you're consuming Coke and you're doing it in an environment that evokes positive sentiments, you're likely to think positively about the item that you're consuming too, and hence you found it at, it became associated with the national pastime, baseball, you find it at carnivals, at fairs. That's because food that's convivial is food that we want. And sometimes we don't think about making alternative food fun too. You know, we give kids fresh fruits and vegetables, but we don't attach with it some of those positive sentiments that I think we have to think about too, which might then lead to healthier choices as well. So it's No One Eats Alone is about that whole story that goes along with what's made industrial food enticing, and also that whole story that we need to tell to make alternative foods enticing too.
Well, Michael, you just about answered every question I was going to ask you today. But what I want to get into in just a moment is looking at how these choices are made for us, and also the whole idea of collective forgetting that you talk about. But before we get there, we have another very important homegrown item we need to talk about, and that is keeping KBOO Radio alive and thriving. And Tove and Will are over in the large studio, and we're going to chat about why you should be supporting KBOO.
That's right. Thank you very much, Barbara. And it's great to be here. My name is Will. I'm here with Tave. I got a room full of eager volunteers waiting to answer those phone calls. So if you folks out there want to pledge your support, and I know you do, it's very important, and you support KBOO, that's why you're listening, and we working here love to hear those phones ring. So pick up the phone, dial 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO, and you can get that wonderful MediaZilla t-shirt. I recommend pledging about $10 a month. That's pretty affordable, easy to do. $10 a month, that's nothing, a pittance, but it will keep KBOO going, keep KBOO on the air, and you will be showing your support for this wonderful community resource. Isn't that right, Tave?
That's right, Will. The airwaves are a part of the common treasury. They belong to all of us. Everybody deserves to hear important news that KBOO brings you, and you, our grassroots supporters, are keeping us independent. So we depend on you to keep our community strong. So call and become a member now.
That's right.
877-500-5266. And the exciting thing right now is during the rest of this show, we have a book as a thank you gift called No One Eats Alone. And so that book is by Michael S. Carolyn. Totally interesting and very apropos to our wonderful conversation we're having here today. No One Eats Alone, that book can be yours. And if you call up right now, 877-500-5266.
What's the donation on that?
Well,
for the book?
If you make your $10 a month donation, then you have an option. You could get that book, or you could get the MediaZilla t-shirt. Heck, you could get a Higher Being t-shirt. But the amount is even a little less than that. But $10 a month will get you that and get you a smile and a thank you. So call us at 877-500-5266. Those of you who are online listening, you can also go to kboo.fm and clicking on donate.
That's right. It couldn't be easier.
It's a wonderful thing to know that you are making a difference. KBOO speaks to issues that you face every day, and it's through this vast set of perspectives and voices that we make a difference, and we are doing stuff that is not being done at other stations or other media in general, for that
That's
matter.
Right. And the people who put on these shows, they're not just journalists going out to get the story. They are interested in the story. They care about the story, and that's why they're working on the program, and that's why they're bringing it to you. And almost everybody here is a volunteer. There's a few members of staff, and they aren't paid huge money, that's for sure. They do it because they love KBOO, they love Portland, and they love these issues that really matter to you, me, Tave, the volunteers waiting to answer the phones. So keep those phones ringing by dialing 877-500-5266.
Tave and Will, I kind of wanted to jump in for a second. This
sure.
is Barbara here, and I'm a very long-time KBOO volunteer, so long that it sort of boggles my mind. And actually,
well, thank you, Barbara.
KBOO is one of the things that drew me to Portland and kept me in Portland.
Yep.
And I think that's true for a lot of people, because we provide not just a really important information and music you won't hear anyplace else, but a real sense of community.
That's right.
And I think a really great way to join that community is to call 877-500-5266 or go online to kboo.fm and click on the donate button. And I want to say that the issue we're talking about today, which is food, mm-hmm. and how we basically reclaim what my guest calls foodscapes, is really important. It's really important to the community. It's one of these issues that KBOO has been in the forefront of talking about way before Michelle Obama mm-hmm. took it on, and way before it became a lot more mainstream. And I think that's one thing to really appreciate about KBOO, is we are on the leading edge of bringing issues to the forefront that really affect your life, that you can become involved in, and we push the mainstream media to eventually pick up the issues themselves.
That's right.
That's
feed
right.
yourself and feed the community and keep feeding this radio station.
And feed your head with this amazing information.
It's so right. Call us at 877-500-5266. Make your $10 a month pledge today, and we've got this book, No One Eats Alone. And I will guarantee you, you will not be alone with KBOO. You are part of an incredible community.
That's right. And when you pledge your support at 877-500-5266, you're making this community happen, keeping it alive and keeping it important. Portland's a great place. That's why so many people move here. That's why the rents have gone up so high. But you can still afford to support KBOO by dialing 877-500-5266. Where else are you going to find these amazing shows like Barbara Bernstein works on so hard?
It's nourishment for your ears.
That's right.
Well, I want to thank Dove and Will for letting us know why you should become a member of KBOO, and we're going to be back talking to you again in a little while. In the meantime, we're talking this morning with Michael Carolan, who is the author of No One Eats Alone, and we're talking about how do we reclaim what Michael calls foodscapes. So that's one question for you, Michael, first of all, is why do you call the milieu in which we find our food a foodscape as opposed to food systems?
Right. That was also done strategically in order to evoke that particular question, too, because my concern with the food system term, which is now becoming quite in vogue, is that it seems to be reduced to what we might refer to in economic speak as a value chain. And that's certainly a valuable and real component of our food lives around us. But there's more to food than just the value chain. One of the assumptions of the value chain, for instance, is that at the end of it, there is a consumer, which there are, but consumers provides a very narrow understanding of who we are as people, as humans, as eaters. Consumers assume it's based upon the idea of the marketplace as a grand democracy, where you vote with your pocketbook. And the problem with that vision of democracy when it comes to creating social change, of course, is that those that have the most money have the most votes. And if we really want to challenge the status quo, we have to think beyond that. And so I really wanted to talk about foodscapes and talk about food citizens rather than consumers to kind of push that idea that if you really want to change things, you can't just vote with your dollar. You have to become involved. You have to become involved with your community. And I think that's also important to as a way of including the most marginalized and disadvantaged people in our society as well, because as long as social change is reduced to what you can buy, that leaves a whole segment of the population out of the equation about how we reimagine what our future food worlds ought to look like.
Now, I've heard a term, vote with your fork, as opposed to vote with your pocketbook. And that's a term that was popularized by, among other people, Anna Moore LaPay. And I wonder if you see there's a difference between voting with your fork and voting with your dollars.
I do. I do, definitely, in part because the idea of voting with your fork, I think, expands our understanding of what it means to do social change and think about reimagining our food systems. I try to provide in the book, actually, rather than pontificating about how bad things are, I actually spend a lot of time giving real-life examples showing that we don't have to really reinvent anything. There's examples all around the world of people reimagining foodscapes in successful ways that also include socially and economically disadvantaged people. And so that idea of voting with your fork, I think, speaks to some of those examples where people are able to leverage community resources rather than, say, financial capital and just money, and using those resources in ways that actually are able to make meaningful social change for people regardless of their income bracket.
Well, another thing I wanted to get back to, you sort of briefly touched in the beginning of the show about the collective loss of memory, or we call it collective amnesia. And this is something that I think is of concern across the board, across our cultural spectrum. It's not just about food. It has a lot to do with a whole lot of ways. As an example, a number of years ago, I was in California, and I was doing a lot of interviewing all around the Bay Area, and I made a comment to a younger friend of mine who was at that point living in Santa Cruz about how the drive between Berkeley and Santa Cruz was just so appalling. And I said, it used to be, you know, all farmland between there 25 years ago. That was 25 years ago back then, about 20 years ago. And she looked at me and says, I thought it was always this way. I thought it was always industrialized. And I realized, you know, I had the same relationship when I came to Portland, and Portland was surrounded by farms. And I remember my father talking about the city in central New England that I grew up in that had been surrounded by farms when he was a kid. And so I had the opportunity to see Oregon in a much more rural and, well, somewhat more natural state in the early 70s than it is now. and also California for that matter. And I appreciated that I had that memory because I was around all these people who didn't have that memory. And if you don't have that memory, then you don't know what you're missing and you don't know what you need to maybe reclaim or rebuild. So I want to talk a little bit more about what causes this collective amnesia. You sort of made it sound like as a conspiracy of Big Ag and other parts of the corporate capital hegemony. But what do you think causes it? And then how do we respond to it when we find ourselves lost in it?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's a little, I don't want to sound conspiratorial. I just happened to have an individual who talked about how he recalls actively trying to get people to forget how to cook back in the 60s. A lot of times, though, it's, I don't want to say it's necessarily more innocent, but it's just an artifact of engaging in different routines and different practices that intentionally or unintentionally result in us remembering some things and forgetting others. And your examples with regard to agriculture are spot on. As our agricultural practices change, we tend to acquire knowledge that's best suited for the, you know, the reality that is agriculture. And we forget some of those realities that are no longer part of agriculture. You know, perhaps some most obvious examples are things like saving seeds and other elements like that, which are really part of a lot of alternative foodscapes. And we can forget some of those practices. And the dangers of forgetting those practices, and your earlier comment, Barbara, kind of speaks to that, is there's a risk of forgetting what we forgot. And then once that happens, we don't even know we don't know it anymore, right? And so that's one of the difficulties when it comes to these practices. But these are not just practices we're talking about either. There's a term I use in the book that's well known in the anthropological community that's biocultural diversity. This is kind of how I talk to students about why cultural diversity is so important if they can't value it in its own right. And it's that our cultural practices are what allow us to continue to replant seeds and engage in practices that preserve biological diversity. And once we forget how to, for example, save seeds or how to plant seeds, or once we lose the taste for a particular food item, you know, where's the incentive or drive to continue to plant that food item? And so we not only lose knowledge, we use biological material, we lose biological diversity. And so it's a large issue that just goes beyond cultural artifacts. It touches us in lots of ways. So then the question of how do you reacquire that? You know, when I referred to finding ways of creating social change that also include marginalized groups, you know, one of the difficulties of acquiring new skills, of course, is when you're poor, there's a positive statistical relationship between financial poverty and time poverty. You know, when you're poor, you tend to not have a lot of free time on your hands because you're working multiple jobs and perhaps taking care of kids or elderly. So we also have to think about ways in which we can not only create food, but also create time for people so that they can acquire some of these skills. And this gets back to my point about how we have to move beyond kind of these individualistic ways of thinking about social changes and voting with your dollar and thinking about how we can leverage community resources. And so I point to examples where people might be able, a community might be able to utilize, say, a vacant kitchen space, which is a type of built capital where you can bring people in. There's sufficient space, there's sufficient equipment where they can use, which they can utilize to acquire new cooking skills. And then you can utilize volunteer efforts and others in the community who might actually have free time, and then provide free, say, childcare, and also provide perhaps free transportation for those that do not have access to cars or may have to rely upon an inefficient public transportation system to bring people in so that they can attend these meetings. But then also you can take advantage of some cultural capital in the community by having members with different ethnic backgrounds take turns so that people are not just being taught how to what we refer to in kind of the food studies community as just eating white, but also learning to eat different cultural cuisines to speak to that biocultural element. And so bundling all these community resources together in a way that makes meaningful social change that benefits everybody, that's kind of, we have to think strategically when it comes to providing people with skills, because there's a lot of barriers that go along with that. And one big one is time. And that's a difficult one to handle that we really can only accomplish when we work together as a community.
Well, we're talking this morning with Michael Carolyn, who's the author of No One Eats Alone. And we're talking this morning about how to reclaim our connection to our food and make it both more meaningful and probably also more nutritious, and how that's connected to basically building ultimately democratic societies here. And we're going to continue and talk a little bit more about experiential learning about our food when we get back. Right now, we're going to be joined by Tave and Will to talk about why you need to support KBOO. We're in the middle of our pledge drive right now, and the number to call to become a member of KBOO, which was a very important part of becoming part of a member of the community here, you need to call 877-500-5266 and become a member of KBOO.
That's right. Thank you very much, Barbara Bernstein. She works so hard on the show. I've known Barbara a long time, and it's amazing how much she cares and how much work is involved in putting these shows together. And we are very lucky to have the book, No One Eats Alone, available for you if you call up. It's $75. That could be broken down to $6.25 a month or one-time donation of $75. Whatever your budget can afford, it's so important that you pick up the phone right now to pledge your support for something I know you believe in, and that's KBOO Community Radio. Dial 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO. And Tave, my friend over here, has a list of some of the people who've already picked up their phone and pledged their support, just as I know you are going to.
Who are those folks? Will, we have a number of people who phoned in. Zach is a new member, and he is from Newton, Iowa.
So,
thank you, Iowa. Big shout out to you out there.
Yep.
Jerry is a Renew from Portland. We have Demetra, who's a Renew from Wilsonville. Thanks, Wilsonville. And Dan is a first-time donor from Vancouver, Oregon.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks, Dan. And all of you who are not members yet or people who have never donated before and you'd like to call and make a donation or walk in, we'd love to have you. Terry is also a Renew from Northeast Portland, so let's keep those bells ringing. The airwaves are a part of the common treasury. I mentioned it before, and we're committed to underrepresented views, such as this one we're talking about right now in the book, No One Eats Alone. That book can be yours for a $75 one-time donation, which will get you a membership, or you could break it out into monthly payments. You are our grassroots supporters.
That's right. Making
KBOO happen. And pick up your phone and call us at 877-500 KBOO or KBOO.FM and click donate.
That's right. And freedom of speech is such an important and valuable thing available in this country. Many other countries censor. We wouldn't even be able to be on the air in many other countries. But thankfully, in America, you can listen to KBOO Community Radio. And you can listen to it in Iowa. You can listen to it in New York. You can listen to it down in Florida. But you can listen to it online. And it's also easy to donate online at KBOO.FM. And how is it? It's a slash or something, right? I'm not very technologically savvy.
If you go to KBOO.FM and click donate, you can donate. But if you go to KBOO.FM/listen, you can listen to us from anywhere in the United States, and you will not be alone. This is your homegrown radio station, so donate today.
And it makes you part of the community.
Thanks, Tave and Will, and we'll talk to you in a little bit. We're talking this morning with Michael Carolyn, who's the author of No One Eats Alone. And now, Michael, I wanted to talk about the difference between some traditional ideas of nutrition and eating education that you kind of slam in your book and the whole idea of experiencing the transformation of becoming part of an alternative foodscape, as you would call it. I'm thinking about a couple programs that I've been around. There's an amazing program in Richmond, California called Urban Tilth, where they are training all kinds of young people in the community, which is a very marginalized, low-income food desert, basically. They're training these kids to become gardeners and farmers, and they learn. They run a number of community gardens in all kinds of locations around the, mostly in the flatlands of Richmond, but also somewhat in the hills. And they train these kids not just how to grow food, but also how to become leaders. And a big part of the program is having these cooking classes they have in the high schools where they teach the kids not only how to grow their own food, but how to cook it and eat it. And it's really been changing the values and the appreciation these kids have. And one young man that we talked to said that he realized from being part of this program that what he used to eat wasn't food at all, because he used to just live on a diet of burgers and fries and Coke. And now he really appreciates eating his own vegetables that he grows stir-fried. And how would you, do you see that as a very important part of making this change, that we really have to start in the schools? I'm thinking of another program here in Portland at Abernathy School, where there's been this garden for a number of years called the Garden of Wonders. And the kids are responsible for the garden, and a lot of the produce that they grow is incorporated into their their school lunches, which are what's one of the few schools in Portland where the lunches are cooked at the school in a scratch kitchen, as opposed to being cooked centrally some far off location. So how do you see that those two programs could have an impact that you're hoping to see where people actually reclaim their food systems?
Right. Well, both of those examples you provided, first off, make these alternative foodscapes more convivial. It's not about thinking about how to deal with things on an individualistic basis, such as providing nutritional literacy where you're treating individuals as just isolated individuals and trying to tell them that they ought to consume food because it's healthy. I've never met anybody that doesn't realize that fresh fruits and vegetables are healthy. So clearly there has to be something else going on there that just that could be reduced to knowledge deficit. And so I think those examples are great ones in that you're creating a community while you're trying to create an alternative foodscape. So they're making food convivial, but they're also, in some respects, leveraging those community resources that I talked about earlier, utilizing existing spaces, bringing people together, creating what we might call, what I might call as a sociologist, social capital, and maybe even creating political capital too, which could be utilized and leveraged to create larger and broader social changes as those youths become community leaders themselves. And there's also another important piece, Barbara, that I just want to spend a few seconds talking about, too, when it comes to experiential learning that we don't think enough about. And I talk about this in the book, too. It's learning empathy. You know, one of the real issues, I think, one of the major problems that's gripping our society today is, to some degree, this lack of empathy that exists. I mean, we talk about blue states and red states. But when you look at some really interesting data that has emerged recently, we're realizing that these political divisions go all the way down to the county, zip code, and maybe even neighborhood levels. You know, we talk a lot about how society today in the United States has become very polarized, and there's real data that back that up. The competitive districts, for instance, in 1997 were at 164. After the most recent election, they're down to 72. And I know a lot of people chalk that up to gerrymandering, but there's a phenomena that those that study this are calling it geographic sorting. These competitive districts are actually becoming more homogenous. So, well, how does this tie back to food? And I try to talk about, and I give examples how some of these alternative foodscapes, by bringing people together from different socioeconomic backgrounds, might actually not even convey knowledge when it comes to learning how to save seeds and things like that, but actually might have the power to engender some understanding and empathy from people that are different from themselves. Now, this isn't the case with all foodscapes, because some foodscapes tend to be very homogenous themselves and very white. But those that are strategic in the sense of truly working to bring people from different ethnic, religious, and socioeconomic backgrounds together have the potential of actually healing some of these broader social and political rifts that are plaguing our society too. So they're really interesting spaces for innovation and experimentation that in ways that we might not even think about.
Well, now, as I was reading your book, and this comes from where I live in kind of a weird place, Portland, you know, we're trying to keep it weird. And there is a strong sense about food and local food and healthy food and food being part of community here that is maybe bigger than it is in other parts of the country. So I might have a warped out view. But it seems to me that even when I travel, that there is a growing, a really growing community of people that appreciate the kinds of relationship to food that you talk about. And I was just thinking about this, how we make food more enticing to people. And one of the big shifts in food consciousness in this area in the last 10 years has been appreciation of kale. And there was a cartoon in the Oregonian a few election cycles ago when the Portland City Council was having an election, and it had each person who was running for council giving their position on kale and how much they love kale. Huh. And I thought, this is an indication that something has really shifted. So I'm not sure that's in your world, but anyway, that's here in Portland.
That's very interesting. Yeah, that is not in my world. No, right.
So you should spend more time here. You might become a little more optimistic, actually. Actually, on that note, it's time to talk to Tave and Will again about supporting kale by supporting KBOO. And maybe if you eat more kale, you'll become more of a member of KBOO. What do you think?
I think it's definitive that's going to happen. And if you call up 877-500-5266, you can be a part of this food movement. Michael's talking about the alternative foodscapes, and here at KBOO, we bring you alternative soundscapes. You want delicious, nutritious programming. We all need that kind of food, but we need it for our ears as well. So please pick up your phone, make a one-time $75 donation, or split it out over $6.25 a month. But that $75 will get you this book by Michael Carolyn, No One Eats Alone, and you can call us at 877-500-5266, or go online to kboo.fm and click on donate, and you can have that wonderful book. Also, actually, food, we're big foodies here in Portland. I have a podcast through KBOO called Peace, Love, and Soup, and so food is very near and dear to my heart, but a lot of it is also all about different cultures that we bring together through food, and KBOO produces broadcasting in a number of different languages as well, and I know that's important to people in the community. We have programs in Italian, Farsi, Yiddish, Russian, and we have had Spanish language programming for over 26 years, and I know that is important to you, so please pick up your phone now and call 877-500-5266 and make your $75 donation today. Will.
That's right. Dial 877-500-5266. And diversity is important. Diversity in opinions, diversity in music, diversity in your diet. Everything that KBOO offers is important. And we offer so many different kinds of shows and so many different sources of information. And where else do you find this? That's the question you got to ask yourself. Where else could you find this programming? My answer, nowhere but here at KBOO. So please pick up the phone and dial 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO. You know, there's another way you can donate your money. You can come down here. We're at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, just off Burnside. Really easy to find. There's a beautiful mural up front. I believe Michelle is working the front desk right now. Come in, have a cup of coffee, meet the staff, meet some of the volunteers, and become part of your community by dialing 877-500-5266 or come on down here or get online. It's up to you, but whatever you do, please make a donation right now. It's so important.
I just want to insert that actually if you come on down to the station, not only is Michelle the receptionist and she'll welcome you, but my dog Karina is also there. She's the reception
cool.
dog.
Oh,
and
Karina.
So you can get to pet a really sweet dog and then
she
you can
is.
Come in and give us some money.
You can come all the way to the back and hand deliver cash, greenbacks to us if you don't want a paper trail, and I'll say hi to you and just you can actually see Will and I here pitching.
That's right. And Karina is a sweetie. I've known Karina a long time, and that is a very sweet dog. So I mean, that's a great opportunity.
It is. And that's what makes KBOO such a wonderful place.
That's
it's,
right.
It's real. It's personal. This is not something that is just at arm's length. We're right here and part of your community. We always welcome people who are homeschooling and want to bring their kids in, show them what local radio looks like. If you are caring for an elder and you'd like to bring them down for a little field trip and something exciting, come on down. We're just a little bit south of Burnside. You can also just call us at 877-500-5266 and show your support that way. $75 donation will get you a membership, and also No One Eats Alone, Michael S. Carolyn's wonderful book.
So easy and so important. Please call us at 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO.
Thanks, Barbara, again, for all this programming you're bringing us to.
Well, thank you. And thanks, Tave and Will, for letting us know why it's so important to join KBOO. Well, in the last few moments of the show, whom we're talking this morning with Michael Carolyn, author of No One Eats Alone, I wanted to get back to the idea of being a citizen eater. What does that mean?
Well, it's again, it kind of pushes the idea that you have to, in order to change a food system, you have to think beyond just the notion of consumer sovereignty. You know, when you look at our industrialized foodscape, you know, there's a lot of choice editing that we refer to as choice editing that happens, which is simply to say that a lot of our choices are already made for us to the point where it's essentially a choice between Coke and Pepsi. When you look at value chains in terms of a grocery store and where things come from, it may look like a panoply of choice, but all of that stuff is coming from ultimately just a handful of large industrial companies. And so if you want to be able to really generate social change, you have to think beyond just what you can do at the grocery store. And you have to think politically. You have to think what you can do as a community, how you can leverage resources together to help all folks and not just those that can buy what they want. And so pushing that point about citizenship is important, because when we're citizens, that recognizes that we don't just buy stuff, but we live in a community. We don't want to see it soiled. We have children whom we love, who we want to see taken care of. We have interests. We have desires. We're just not interested in getting the best deal. It pushes our envelope in terms of how we think about what we need to do in order to change things.
Now, how do you think that working as a food citizen could actually help us to kind of restore democracy to this country, and particularly in the tenor of times right now? I'm not sure if you finished your book before or after Trump was elected president, but I wonder how the struggle that you see in the guys that, well, he's taking away all the food guidelines that came, that Michelle Obama in particular inspired for public school nutrition guidelines.
Right.
What are the new challenges that you see under the Trump administration, and how can becoming a food citizen really stand up to that and maybe push things forward on a local level?
Yeah, I think about that a lot. I get that question a lot too. So on the one hand, what does the political reality look like? I can only guess it's not encouraging when it comes to those of us that are trying to create real change within our food systems or our foodscapes. But also I see, though, within some of these alternative foodscapes, to bring up a point I mentioned earlier, there's some element of hope, too, especially talking about the incredible polarizations that exist in our society that are greater that we've seen, at least in some generations. I tell a number of stories. One that I've retold many times that I find quite enduring, I refer to as the strawberry study, where I got a group of people together that were very different socioeconomically speaking, because I was really interested in how experiential learning impacts how people think about food. And so I recruited very different people, and I put them through, in some respects, different types of scenarios where initially they were shown documentaries about strawberry production. And then it ended with them spending a whole day in the field picking strawberries, hot summer day, 8 hours. And then after every one of those kind of exposures, they were asked a series of questions about how they thought about food. And that after the documentary, they started to know more about where their food came from and who purchased, who harvested it. But it wasn't until they were out in the field where I started to made some really interesting observations. During that experiment, too, they were also told or asked to take pictures as they were working in the field. And what was really interesting about that particular element of the study is that at the beginning of the day, they were taking landscape pictures, as you might imagine someone doing. But then by the end of the day, they began taking pictures of their soiled hands, their sweaty baseball caps, and really trying to document the physicality of the labor. And after a few days, then there was an exit interview in some respect. They asked them about what that experience was like for them. And for a number of respondents, they actually talked about how that physicality of working in the field actually gave them some understanding of what it must be like to be a worker who has to, for a living, have to do that just to survive. And so I think we can also think about, as I mentioned, some of these spaces of ways of engendering empathy within people, whether that empathy is made by people working alongside other people that are different from themselves, politically speaking, socially and culturally speaking, or giving people an opportunity to do the types of practices they might not otherwise do, but who people who are more invisible in our foodscape, practices that they have to do just to make a living. And in that, I think there might be some hopeful elements in terms of healing some of those larger rifts that exist in our society that are giving rise to some of the political phenomena that we're seeing happening today.
So even if we have a president who lives on junk food, there's still some hope.
Yes, there most definitely is. I talk to students who see the world in very gray and black and white terms and not in very hopeful terms. And I My stories don't go as far back, it sounds, as yours, Barbara, but I've been around long enough to see some real hopeful things happening, too. And so sometimes I just have to put things in historical context for my students as well to let them know that, you know, 15 years ago, people weren't talking about what they're talking about. They certainly weren't eating kale, like, to reference the story you're referencing. So I do certainly see in the long view us heading in the right direction. This just happens to be, I hope, a shortly lived tangent in what is otherwise a hopeful tick upward.
I hope actually that it's a good lesson that will really propel us in a good direction once we get out of this particular nightmare. Well, it's really good to talk with you, Michael. Thanks a whole lot for joining us.
Thank you so much, Barbara.
We've been talking with Michael Carolyn, who's author of No One Eats Alone, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online, or you can download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk with Kendra Kimberaskis, who's with the Socially Responsible Agriculture Project, and we're going to talk about the threat that mega dairies, those giant CAFOs over in the gorge, East Gorge, pose to Oregon. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. I want to encourage you to become a member of KBOO right now by calling 877-500-5266 while we go out with some music by Kate and Anna McGarrigle. Thanks for listening.
Kitchen table by the light that switches on. I eat leftovers with mashed potatoes. No more candlelight, no more romance, no more small talk when the hunger's gone. I eat dinner at the kitchen table.